Senate Subcommittee on Rules. Come to order. Subcommittee of the Rules and Administration Committee on Permanent and Joint Rules. Mr. Watson, I think what you did first was the various things we were chatting about last week that seemed to be kind of consensus items you've drafted into. Why don't we deal with the rules of the Senate first? Permanent rules of the Senate. Why don't you go through that packet?
Mr. Chairman, you should have in your packets a memorandum from me to Senator Pogemiller on the permanent rules of the Senate that describes the changes in the permanent rules that are incorporated in the draft resolution, which should be the next thing in your packets. First is the change to rules 4.5 to 4.7, correcting the names of the Senate committees to agree with those adopted in the temporary rules. 4.8, requiring rules, memorials, and other resolutions that must follow the same procedure as bills to be referred before passage to the Committee on Rules and Administration.
Which ones are not that?
Pardon me?
Which ones are not the same procedure as bills? Are there some resolutions that are not the same procedure as bills?
Mr. Chairman, the vast majority of resolutions are ones congratulating basketball teams, Eagle Scouts, and so forth on doing wonderful things. And those are just referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. They don't have to follow the same procedure.
Is there something around here that already says that they go there, or we just do it by practice?
Mr. Chairman, that's just a custom of the Senate. Well,
so why not?
Actually, there is a rule that says that resolutions not offered by the Committee on Administration will be referred to the Rules Committee.
Wouldn't it be cleaner just on 225 to just all resolutions must be referred to?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know that, because as an example, the ones that on education, you know, they went to the Education Committee more properly first to let them do it. But before you get to the floor, I think you want them to go to the Rules Committee. If it has no other place to go, I think the Rules Committee would be the proper place of referral. But some of these resolutions dealing with urging Congress to do something, I guess, should go to the Policy Committee, not to the Rules Committee.
Mr. Chairman, that has been the practice. Memorial resolutions go to a policy committee first, and then they go to the Rules Committee.
We'll have to change it next year, Senator Metzen.
That's fine with me.
All right, continue.
Rule 7.5 on page 4 just changes the names of the budget bills to agree with the names of the budget divisions established by the organizing committee. Rule 8.2, the bottom of page 5, line 5.30, changes the time for an appointment to languish in committee before it has to come up to the floor from 1 year to 60 legislative days, which is about a year, maybe a little bit less than a year. So it could require it to come up before the end of the first regular session instead of being maybe the middle of the second year.
Mr. Chair, I don't remember if you were here for the discussion on that, but it's theoretically possible for the governor to submit a appointment like in late April of the odd-numbered year. And if we start in March of the next year, you know, we really haven't had much time between the two, but a year will have passed. So I think this actually ties it more to the legislative calendar, not to the real calendar.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the change to Rule 10.2 is on page 6, line 29. It increases the time that the minority group has to make their committee assignments from 10 calendar days to 14 calendar days. That was a request of Senator Senjum. The change to Rule 10.6 clarifies your authority to add members to a division or subtract members from a division. And the change to Rule 47 is on page 20, and it adds to the bills that must be returned to committee at the close of the session in the first year, bills that have been laid on the table, provides an exception for bills that have been vetoed by the governor and laid on the table, or bills that were in conference committee and returned to the table and the conference committee discharged.
Hey, Devil.
Again, I don't think that one was not one that people were concerned about, right?
I don't remember if we had any issues of concern. We discussed it, but I don't recall. And Mr. Chair, just since Senator Neville came in, I'm not pursuing the other one on the recall for the committee. Not in here, so.
This was the one that dealt with the...
people laying bills on the table.
Yeah. Okay. Continue.
So, Mr. Chairman, that completes the changes to the rules of the Senate that seemed to be uncontroversial at the last meeting. And that's all that's in this draft resolution is the uncontroversial things.
Okay, then let's deal with a couple of the other items. So we were discussing, I wanted to go to three members on the subcommittee on committees, and in discussions with Senator Metzen and some others, why don't we pass that one out? The idea would be to...
15-1?
The idea would be to, on the subcommittee on conference committees, go to three members. But on the subcommittee on committees, at least five members. Currently, it's five. And to go to at least, so that we can make it, in this instance, I would think we should make it 4-2. 4-minority, 2-minority. And on the subcommittee on conference committees, I think it's just a little more transparent to say that that's basically a decision that typically kind of gets made between the majority leader and the minority leader. And so my intent there would be to have the majority leader and minority leader, and in this instance, Senator Clark is the third member, would allow the committees, the one that appoints commissions and things, to be balanced. In the current situation, either has to be 3-2 or 4-1. There's a little more flexibility. Matter of fact, I had a draft of who I was thinking on. So, first, Mr. Watson, why don't you explain the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, the first part of the amendment is a change to Rule 11.1. That's the subcommittee on committees and its role appointing everything other than conference committees. And you'll see that under the current language, it's five members, one a member of the minority group. But the change is to make it, as the chairman indicated, at least five members, and then make the membership proportional, majority and minority. The second part is a change to Rule 46, and that's what has been the subcommittee on committees and its role appointing conference committees. And this role, it would be called the Subcommittee on Conference Committees, a new name, new committee, and it would be just three members, including one member of the minority group.
And the intent on the Subcommittee on Conference Committees would it have it be Hogemiller, Senjum, and Clark. And my sense is that actually strengthens the minority leader a little bit, because that, tells everybody, look, here's how this decision's really made anyway, so why don't we just be straightforward about it? And then the subcommittee and committees, mix that up a little bit, and I thought it would be Pogemiller, Berglund, Metzen, Jen Olson, Senjum, Stumpf, and Erickson Ropes, which I think is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, it's 7, not 6. It could be 6. I think the reason we were talking about 7 is I lived through that 4-2 thing in a tax committee once where it's an even number and you can never get anything done. But we can either have 7 or 6 there. But it should be at least 4-2. And I was thinking Senator Olson and Senator Senjum. So Senator Metzen moves the 15-1 amendment.
I so move.
Oh. Oh, I guess I have to say something. Based on the Metz and any discussion on the Metz and motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Yeah, you got to call for the
opposed.
Aye.
Well, else if we did this, huh?
Motion. That makes Senator Clark the swing vote on that.
Yeah. Motion's adopted.
A lot of power there.
Yeah. Well, I think we all.
He was nicer.
But we all do know.
Have some new friends.
Again, I just want to. I think it's pretty clear to everybody around here how those conference committees typically get set. It's a. You get recommendations by the chair of the conference. You typically try to put on members that were most active in the bills. Very rarely do you make a change from that, but you do every so often. But that would then be one where we'd be trying to accommodate Senator Senjum as best as possible. Sure. Not that there's always going to be total agreement on those, but that's really kind of how it's worked in the past. Senator Metzen sat there.
Chairman, you and I have talked about this a couple times, and I think this gets me to where I want to go, and I think a lot of our members agree with me on this one, too.
So that was adopted. Then we have, now are we down to Pappas and?
Senator Marty.
Is Senator Marty here? Senator Pappas here? Anybody, any other amendments that are there that members of this committee wanted to talk about?
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing else on the Senate rules.
Okay, let's take a look at then Marty's amendment. Or is it one or two?
It's 13-1.
We check with his office again and just see if he's coming. Apparently, members of the have seen this amendment before.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, this is an issue that Senator Marty and in the previous years, sometimes Senator Dill and others have raised to increase the number of authors of a bill. I think this is the first time the number 15 has been chosen. There have been other numbers and unlimited.
Now, for full disclosure, it's pretty apparent that the professional staff in the Senate doesn't like this amendment. So, so we're just giving full disclosure. Is anyone on the committee interested in the amendment? Senator Neville.
I'd offer it.
Okay, Senator Neville offers the 13-1. Senator Neville, would you want to make an argument for it? Or?
Well, I think there are two basic arguments. Despite what staff says, I still think it would reduce some clone bills. But I think it also gives the chief author a chance to do some building of support for a particular bill. I think it makes a difference if you could introduce a bill with 15 authors or co-authors. Might if you get three clone bills, you got a majority.
which has never guaranteed that the bill.
I think there are a lot of bills around here that that people want to say I'm a co-author on because they really do support it, and this gives the chief author more ability to build coalition support.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, may I ask perhaps Mr. Watson, where did 5 come from? Is it is that from statehood or?
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum, 5 came from 3, which is the number it was when I started in 71, sometime after that. I don't remember when, maybe Mr. Flavin remembers when it went from 3 to 5. And what it was before 3, I don't know. For how long?
Anything to add, Mr. Flavin, on that topic? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's any secret based on past discussions that the staff isn't enthused about more than 5 members. We see evidence of...
Well, first, why don't we answer the question first?
I'm sorry.
From 3 to 5, do you know how it got there? Or when?
It was... I don't know, in the 70s or in the 80s, I would guess.
Was it ever less than 3? Was it 1 at one point?
I don't know. Mike?
0. Nobody.
We don't know that it was less than 3.
Okay. So, thank you, Mr. Bond. Senator Marty, we're chatting about the 13-1 amendment. Senator Neville has moved it. There's a reiteration that the professional staff in the Senate has never been warm to this.
Mr. Chairman, I'm aware of that. I know already this year of a couple of bills where there have been a number of co-authors and where people have decided, because we don't have enough spots on a bill, they've authored copycat bills or clone bills or whatever you want to call them. The whole concept of co-authors we've decided as a Senate is some way to show support for a bill. I used a smaller number than the House. And frankly, I've noticed that some of the outside groups have decided that this is a way of showing support for bills. They've been announcing which authors are signed onto a bill. And so members who want to be listed positively with those groups seem to be signing on to bills. And if they're full, they introduced a clone bill. It seems to me that a better way of showing support, less expensive way of showing support, would be doing it like the House does, where they have where you have no more than five names on the bill. They apparently have some sign-up list there. They've been doing it for several years. It works. And to me, this would be cheaper and more efficient way of doing it, unless we think there's no merit to the idea of showing other people support for a bill, because we all know the chief author does 99.some% of the work. But I think that this is maybe front desk would disagree, but I think it's cheaper than having the reviser go through and jacket copycat bills. And I know I've seen some in the past where there have been 6, 7, 8 clones of a bill because there are 30, 40 people who choose to sign on them.
Okay. Anybody else want to discuss?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't like the idea of just having people jumping on and off bills and so forth. And I mean, I've signed on to bills and sometimes and then there's changes to the bill that I don't want to be part of, so I take my name off it. And I think that this just worsens the situation. I think a different issue is the fact that even now we have some people walking around with bills in their briefcases trying to get co-authors, and sometimes the bills just don't get introduced in a timely manner simply because they're trying to collect these autographs. And I think this will worsen the situation in some instances where people are trying to max out, and all of a sudden a bill that should have been introduced in maybe January gets introduced in March because they're trying to get 15 co-authors. Oh, by the way, I need an immediate hearing, and it's got to go to three committees. I don't know that we need to change the situation so much. I'm comfortable the way it is right now. But in fact, if I had my way, I'd be down to three. But that's not on the table. So,
Mr. Chair, I confess I'm not 100% positive how the House does it. But House jackets I've seen all have spots for five authors, and people who want to add their name beyond that seem to go and just add their name by motion or however. I mean, we've done it by motion here. Maybe theirs is different than that, but they just have a list you can sign on later, and I don't think they wait for more than five authors to introduce the bill. I think it would be smarter to have them do that, and then if you just, it's a one-line thing on the agenda to add names, co-authors to a bill, and frankly, it doesn't delay it any longer to have 15 if the last 10 are added after the bill is introduced.
Mr. Chair, as I recall, the Green Jackets had the five spots on the front, and then on the back side of the jackets, that's where all the other names can be signed. I believe that that's how they do it. I don't always look at the Green Jackets, but that's how I recall it.
So, Mr. Chairman, you can add the names to the jacket before it's introduced, but just on the back side of the Green Jacket.
Mr. Chairman, if that's the concern, we could just have it that only five would be written on the bill and just have the rest added the way they normally are. I mean, in other words, the point is not to delay the introduction. I've often put in a bill with two authors, knowing there are others who I couldn't reach before I wanted to drop it in, and they add their names later. And it seems to me you could do the same whether it's 2 or 15 or 20. I just remember several years ago hearing how much each jacketing process at the reviser's office costs. Concept of people have been dropping in clone bills. I know it's already happened this year, and this is simply a way people can show their support in a more orderly manner than dropping in 3, 4, 5 redundant bills.
Sir Murray, don't you think it? I, I guess I'm getting so old-fashioned. But I just think it cheapens the authorship when everybody can author a bill. Then it's kind of like, oh, okay, whatever. And isn't one of the problems we have around here that the announcement has actually become more important than the work?
Mr. Chairman, people are doing it regardless of what you like. In Washington, they often have multiple names. I know one bill in the House.
That place works really well, doesn't
it? Well, I'm not arguing that we should copy what they do for every aspect of it, but I do think in the House when they have, I mean, I know one bill somebody told me they had 60-some co-authors, and they do it with two sets of jackets there instead of whatever it would take here to get that, I mean, 35 that we need.
Right, but and this is not to pick on anybody, but I just see this irony. I've been hearing for about 5 or 6 years about how the Wellstone bill for mental health or something has 70 or 80 co-authors in the House of Representatives. And one of them is Congressman Ramstead. Well, now that Congressman Ramstead's actually not in the majority, everybody's saying the bill might actually pass. And I sit there and I kind of go, if it had that many co-authors all these years, why didn't the bill pass? And what we've been told, and this is not criticize Senator Ramstead or Representative Ramstead, we've been told the leadership wouldn't let the bill pass. If there are 15 members of the state Senate for a bill and it doesn't pass, why is that going to be, do you think? That's and Senator Marty, I'm trying to have a realistic discussion here about what really takes place around here. And my observation is that there's way too much emphasis on form rather than substance. And to me, these notions of clone bills and more authors on bills feeds that. That really, it's really about what you say you are. It's not about what you do. And I'm not trying to be overly picking on this proposal, but I think it's frustrating because we've got all kinds of people who say they're for things.
And Mr. Chairman,
and they never pass. And I don't get that. I mean, everybody's for health care, but it never passes. And I mean this bipartisan. I don't mean this at all to be one party or the other. It's just one of those things. As a chair, that's been my observation, that everybody's for everything.
And Mr. Chairman?
I'm not for everything.
I don't.
Senator, he actually just got beaten in an election. Senator Claire, I thought, was one of the more consistent members. He would vote against finance bills and stuff. And I thought, he's consistent. Now, I have no idea if that's what cost him his election. I mean, I simply don't know. But at least there was a certain rhyme or reason to his votes.
They were predictable.
Whereas often, for many members of the Senate, I mean it bipartisanly, sometimes there's no correlation on these votes between what they say and what they do.
Mr. Chairman, I strongly agree with your concern there, and as one who's probably authored, I think when I offer bills that spend money, I offer taxes in the bills usually.
Yes.
I've done that many times, and I agree with you that people try and claim credit for spending more and taxing less. There's a big problem with that. I don't disagree. Whether we have more authors or less on it is not going to change that. If we get rid of all co-authors, it's not going to change that. People are still going to do whatever they want about it. But what I'm saying is that it is a way of showing, hey, this bill isn't just one person's idea. There's strong support for it out there. Why do people go out and get more authors? I think a lot of the groups that are pushing some of these, that one of them, again, I know has 40, 50, 60 some co-authors, they're doing it because they think it's a way to show support in the legislature and people can talk to their colleagues. Once you get half the legislature in co-authoring a bill, then you know leadership is blocking something they shouldn't be, perhaps, because 70 votes in the U.S. House is not a majority of anything. But again, this is not the, this is more a, I think makes the system a little bit simpler and clearer and avoids some redundant bills. It's not like it's going to be a major policy shift. I don't think it is.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chair, somebody very succinctly tell me, why does staff oppose this?
Mr. Flavin.
I don't was wondering if he was going to get his shot at this.
Well, I don't want the long treatise here, just bullet points.
Have your hand up.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, Senator Marty, Senator Marty and I have had discussions about this for a long time, as some other authors. I guess the point of our discussion is that we see the bills that come from the House, and we see these long lists of names, and it doesn't seem to add a lot to the bill. It seems to be sort of strange to have all these names. And I know in the House they have one person who just goes around all day adding names to bills that are out in the various committees. But to make this more succinct, I asked Mike Lynn to take a look at the practice in the House and talk to the House people. And he has a couple of handouts that I thought would be interesting for the committee to see. And we have an example of the journal entries that, Mr. Chairman, you can take a look at and pass around the table. We don't have multiple copies. But if you take a quick look at, I'm going to sit next to Senator Marty so he can see it. In 1999, the House went to multiple authors. And if you look at the handout that looks like this, it's kind of a graph. It's got about half of the page. If you look at the number of House bill introductions, in 1999, when they went to multiple authorships, the number of bill introductions jumped from 3884 to 4181, and then dropped off a little bit and now is building back up again. So as you can see, the practice in the House didn't really reduce the number of bill introductions. And then if you look at the other longer chart, which is continued on the back page, it shows the number of motions, the number of names added to bills as the dates go on in 2003. And so you have an awful lot of time spent and a lot of motions made to add a lot more people to bills. And in the House Journal, you see all those motions. And I think it does kind of cheapen the value of being an author when you see that going by. Now, I know this proposal is for 15, not as many as the House, which is 35. But I guess that's my succinct version, Senator Neville.
Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I mean, these were more subjective issues or comments than they were objective ones about how much extra work staff would do. And if you look at the trends from 99 to, you know, those last four sessions, the Senate follows exactly the same trend. So it goes 38, then it goes down for 2 years, and then for some reason, you know, 506, we jump back up again. There's something else at play fueling that than the co-authorships. And I suspect it was political differences that, you know, people were putting bills in to contrast themselves with other things happening.
Well, Mr. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. That's right.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, in 1999, it clearly didn't reduce the number of bills in a drastic way. And matter of fact, the opposite occurred. And while there was some drop-off, it built back up. So clearly we didn't we didn't see a big reduction in the number of House introductions.
Well, Mr. Chair, we don't know that that's the cause and effect. There's a lot of reasons that that could have.
Well, this year we have something pretty good going on. What are we up to today, staff?
Almost 400.
We're behind our pace. This is good. Thank you, Mr. Fleming. Okay, any further? Thank you very much. Sir Marty, any closing comments?
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Senator Neville. I think that for the people who are offering cone bills, this is going to reduce the number of cone bills. It's not going to have a big impact on that. I just think that that's the way people are trying to get around this rule, and they will continue to do that. But, again, as I said, this is something I think makes it simpler and clearer, but the staff is, it may be more work. That's the issue.
Can I just offer a quick anecdote, Mr. Chair. My first session, I was on the data practice subcommittee, and Senator Knutson introduced a bill that went to the subcommittee. And there were six members on that subcommittee, and he got five of the six on the bill. And, of course, by the time that Senator Merriam, Senator McGowan, Senator Ranum, Senator Finn got done with that, there was nothing left of the bill. They hated it, even though they signed it as co-authors. So then I wanted to introduce the same bill so I could oppose it, too. So I learned my lesson that co-authors may not be as supportive as we may think.
Okay, we have the 13-1 before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed.
No.
Motion was not adopted. Sir Marty, hang around because we'll get to the joint rules in a second. So anything else on the permanent rules? No other amendments. Senator Senjum then moves that. Does anybody else have any other amendments?
What are we on
just
here?
Just to clarify, Mr. Chair, so the only changes we made are those two?
Or no, we had those.
Or were they incorporated?
We incorporated all that consensus stuff from last time. Let's go through it real quick. Mr. Watson, just very briefly go through what those changes are now. If you look at this memo, it's got the...
Mr. Chairman, I think what you need is to have the memo from me to Senator Pogue-Miller on the permanent rules of the Senate, and it lists the 7 changes that are already in the resolution. And we adopted the one amendment that incorporated the changes about the subcommittee on committees. So all of those items then would be included in this resolution that you are about to vote on. That would then go to the full rules committee.
So okay. Does the 14 days?
I see what they do.
Does the 14 days?
Yeah.
Okay. On the sends a motion then to adopt resend rule 07 as amended and refer to the full committee. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Okay, let's go to the joints then.
Chairman, for the joint rules, you should have in your packet a memorandum from me to you on the permanent joint rules, and it shows just one change to the joint rules that's been incorporated into this draft resolution. And if you want to see the language of that change, turn to the last two pages of the joint resolution, concurrent resolution. You'll see that in Rule 4.01, the language relating to the meeting date and composition of the joint committee to recommend nominees for regent of the University of Minnesota is all stricken. And the reason why it is stricken is because in the Higher Education Appropriation Bill of 2005, there was included a statutory change that changed the composition of the committee and the day when it had to meet and what it does in recommending regents. So what is in the current joint rule is overridden by that statute. The number of the statute is section 137.0246, which is referred to in line 9.7 of the resolution. The language on voting viva voce and the joint committee and that a majority vote of the joint committee is required for a candidate to be recommended is left in the resolution simply because that is not a subject that was dealt with in the statute. So that's the only change. It was discussed last time. It seemed not controversial, and that's why it's in the resolution at this point.
Do you have an amendment that doesn't have that reference?
Mr. Chairman, there are two amendments to the joint rules.
It's passing.
And the first one that you might want to take a look at is the...
We're going to pass three amendments out so we don't have to do all three of them here.
It's the 017 amendment. It would delete that line 9.7 and rewrite it to say, at meetings of the Joint Committee established to recommend nominees for Regent of the University of Minnesota, the voting is viva voce. The purpose of that was to eliminate the reference to the statute in the rule.
just makes it a little more utilitarian. Has the same impact.
No,
I told him to pass them all out.
This is one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Has everybody got a copy of this one? Right. Sarah Pappas accomplishes the same thing, just takes out the reference to a statute. Bedsel moves the 017 discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Okay, then we have a Pappas and a Marty.
Mr. Chairman, the next one would be 016.
Okay.
Which gives a date for the joint convention to occur. The statute has a date for the joint committee to meet, but neither the current joint rules nor the statute has a deadline date for the joint convention to meet. So this amendment requested by Senator Pappas would impose April 1 as the deadline for the House and Senate to meet together to elect regents. That deadline could be changed by a concurrent resolution adopted by the two bodies.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, and we gave to the staff a whole explanation of the regent selection process. Maybe people might want to see that. I thought that last year when we made the changes in law that we included this, that we actually set a date by which the joint convention had to be called. Evidently, we must have decided that it was more appropriate to do that in the joint rules, and then no joint rules were adopted. So we could set it earlier. The trick is to limit the time that the regent candidates are needing to campaign or be engaged in the whole process, and to make sure that it happens, and we don't, by default, that happened a few years ago, leave it to the governor to appoint the regent candidates solely without the confirmation of the joint convention. So it could be, I would say April 1st would be the latest it should be called. It could be called earlier even. I picked that date a little arbitrarily. It could be March 15th. The joint committee has to meet to recommend the slate by February 28th, I believe. Is that Mr. Watson? It is.
Senator Bedsel.
Just a clarification, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas. As I recall, a few years ago, the House just did not schedule the joint convention, which I think left it up to the governor, if I remember
right. Mr. Chairman, Speaker Swigum and Majority Leader Moe could not agree on a date.
Okay.
And so no convention was held. And so the governor, Governor Ventura, did have, I believe, three appointments to the Board of Regents.
So, Mr. Chair, perhaps Mr. Watson, does this language then require that there must be a joint convention? It says
yes.
The Senate House shall meet, so we must do that?
We must do it by April 1st.
Okay. What if they don't agree on a date again?
We're in violation of
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bedsel, if they don't do it, then the governor makes the interim appointments.
Okay. So even this language doesn't guarantee that, but it just, if we violate the rules, we violate the rules. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
April 1st is a Sunday.
This year.
But
Mr. Chairman,
February 15th is the other date, Senator Pappas. Apparently,
February 28th. Chairman, it just says it's the joint committee by February 28th. The joint committee must meet to consider the governor's nominees. The governor has to submit a slate by February 15th to the joint committee.
I see.
Okay. It says by April 1st, so it doesn't assume that it's going to be on April 1st. So the date could be set any time between February 28th and April 1st. And I would be happy to, if the committee wanted to consider an earlier date. I just don't think it should be later.
Okay. Okay. Someone want to offer it?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sinjum.
Senator Pappas, may I ask, I'm looking at the Joint Committee, and by February 28th, they must have met to consider. Is there a deadline by which they must make their nominations?
Mr. Chairman, I suppose by the Joint Convention.
So Mr. Chairman, at least per this, that would be April 1st, I guess.
Does somebody want to offer something?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas,
I guess I want to say again, I think that so we don't, this would cause both leaders to kind of recognize that this has to happen, and we wouldn't by default. I mean, we do bring the governor into the process with this new approach, but I don't think we want to leave it to the governor totally to elect the Board of Regents. And if we don't say something in the rules about when the Joint Convention has to be held, then I think that there's less pressure on the leadership to actually call a Joint Convention. I mean, I don't think we anticipated that that wouldn't happen. And 2 years ago, the Joint Convention was held called quite early, which was good, in spite of not having anything in the rules. But, I mean, problems come up, and I think we, as legislators, we try to think of ways that we can fix them so they won't happen again.
You can get a cup.
Do people have more problems or questions with this?
Yeah, Senator Pappas, let me surmise what's going on here.
Uh-huh.
I think most members don't like the statute. And the April 1st, I don't think matters to members probably that much one way or the other.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, I suggest we adopt the April 1st, and then we try the process and see how it works. But the reason
this came out of a conference committee, didn't it?
Partially. It was, you know, there was legislation in both bodies, and it was a conference committee decision. The, you know, this came because regents, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, regents literally came to me and said, there's a problem with the process. You know, we need to figure out some way to fix the process. And this virtually mandates that the Joint Committee and the governor have to negotiate, because otherwise no slate is going to evolve. So there have to be candidates that have bipartisan support that both the legislature and the governor support, or it's not going to happen, or then we go to a free-for-all on the floor again of the Joint Convention.
Senator Clark moves the A. What number is that?
16.
A16?
Is it work? If you want a date, there's a date. You want to have a different date, a later date?
Senator Clark?
Senator Pappas, I think my only real concern with the way this is written is there isn't an actual date. You still have to get an agreement. It doesn't have kind of the no later than or on this date unless. So I don't know if you want an actual date that's no later than, or if you, because if there isn't an agreement like you were describing before, there's nothing in here to compel an actual.
It's a good date or May 1.
I mean, it says we have to, but there's nothing in here that says here's the date you got to do it. So that's my question to you. Is there?
Well, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Watson, how often does the legislature violate their joint rules? And by saying by April 1st, I think that is pretty clear that it's supposed to happen sometime before April 1st.
Mr. Watson, how often does the legislature violate its rules?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that the legislature does violate its joint rules.
Only when they're vague.
The main area of controversy in recent years has been joint rules on conference committees, whether they are meeting as openly as they should be. There's sometimes a question whether the content of a conference report goes beyond what was referred to the conference committee, whether things are germane or not. but I don't recall there being, say, a point of order raised on a conference committee report. Maybe there has been one, but it might be that some things, like with conference committee meetings and reports, maybe they slip by unnoticed, but I don't know that the legislature has openly violated the joint rules.
Mr. Chairman, then I would suggest that if we said that the joint convention has to be held by April 1st, that the leaders will get together and agree on a date for the joint convention before April 1st.
Okay, why don't we make it April 15th? Give the speaker a little more flexibility here. Because they have to adopt this, too.
Yeah.
I think April 15th might be a little... What?
It's fine.
It just...
Specific date?
I think that might just be a little safer. Clark incorporates April 15th. Discussion, Senator Bedzel?
Mr. Chair...
I want to hold it earlier.
Perhaps we could say by the second Monday of April or whatever. So we get if this is adopted, it stays around for a while, you know... I understand that if we say April 15th, it falls on a Sunday, it means before then, but sometimes we can just say do it by the third Monday of April or the second Wednesday
o'clock.
Or something. But,
third Monday by 2 o'clock?
Just on a separate point.
Why don't we just do April 15th?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Mr. Watson, again, refresh my memory. I mean, different part of the rules say the legislature shall establish by concurrent resolution deadlines for each regular session. I seem to remember a few years ago we couldn't do that. And the House had one track and we had a different track. So even though it said we have to establish deadlines in the joint rules, we didn't. So I think it has – there's some precedence in there for us not following the joint rules.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, certainly April 15th is better than not doing it. But the reason – I would hope that we think about – moving it earlier, because the whole reason here is so that we don't have regent candidates running around the Capitol campaigning, you know, week after week after week. That discourages candidates from running if they think it's going to be a 3-month process that they have to be campaigning up here. So we're trying to compress the process if we can.
Want to go back to April 1st?
First
Monday.
April 1st. We'll go back to April 1st. Senator Pappas, one way to avoid having people come around and lobby the legislators is to have people on the list who don't need to be introduced to the legislature. But you and I have had that discussion.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, if we, you know, certainly if an outstanding candidate, we talked about someone like Vice President Mondale, wanted to be a regent, and he came and he talked to legislators, and he did not want to go through the regent candidate selection process because everybody knows him. I think that's a really good argument. The Joint Convention could decide to nominate him. So that could still happen.
Okay. So we have the A16 as drafted April 1st. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed.
No.
Motion adopted. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Then we have... another amendment, I believe. Senator Marty's.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty had asked for an amendment. It's the 014 amendment on conference committees, preventing conference committee members and employees assigned to work for the conference committee from making or accepting offers other than at a meeting that's open to the public.
Where is this?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, when the DFL took control in the early 70s, they came in with the promise they were going to open up the legislative process, and to their credit, they did, and we opened up all committee meetings, including all conference committee meetings. My understanding was for a very short period of time of several years, conference committees really were open, and then it became something that, well, you know, we can get our work better done in private, and so much of the work has been changed now to being negotiated in private, and I don't think that serves the process well. It's too easy to do that way, and I think we tend to gradually drift towards more closed behavior. I've been in some conference committees where it's actually negotiated in private and it's almost reenacted in public meeting then where, well, it's already been agreed upon, but somebody in the Senate will say, well, we're willing to offer this if you'll do that, and the House counters, and you're just sort of play-acting what had already been negotiated. I've been on a few conference committees that do that, but even if that's not done, even if it just comes in and here's an announcement on what we've agreed to, the point of the open meeting law, the point of our open meeting rules is to make sure that the public business is conducted in public, and if it's suitable for every other hearing, it seems to me we could go back to the way it was when they were first opened up. I don't see any reason that we cannot negotiate these issues in public, and I'd urge your support.
Well, Senator Marty, I've chaired 16 conference committees. I've never violated this spirit, the ones that I've chaired. So I think my personal observation is that's simply not true what you've just said for all conference committees. If you've been on conference committees that have been done in private, I think that's a matter for the members. Because conference committees I've chaired simply do not do what you've suggested. They simply do their work in the public. And frankly, one of the criticisms we get is that why don't you guys just go off in a room and solve your bill? And I steadfastly have said no.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't say all conference committees do that. I don't even know that a majority do. I do know a lot of budget ones. I've been in some where they'll have one person or two people come over from the House to make an offer and discuss it and so on. And to negotiate with, and they make sure, oh, we don't have a majority of three people from the House in here or three from the Senate.
Which would be a violation of the open meeting.
That's correct. And so they make sure that there's less than majority there to make and receive offers. And I think it's more than just a matter of, well, if you're a member of the conference committee, you can prefer it be done that way. I think the reality of the dynamics are such that if the chairs choose to do it that way, there's other members of the conference committee really don't have much say in that. And so I guess I would suggest that we've got a reason for having open meetings, and to say that it can be done more efficiently in closed meetings, it may be, but that's probably true.
Marty, I think you're going way beyond that here now. You're saying that there can't be conversations. I think what this language says is there cannot be individual conversations between conferees or staff. I think that's what this says.
Mr. Chairman, it says you cannot make or accept an offer regarding issues in dispute.
And if two people are having a conversation, who's going to be the determinant of whether there's an offer being made during that conversation?
Mr. Chairman, if you're talking about enforcement, I think members here do try and abide by the rules. And I'm not trying to say we have to have policemen in the room making sure it doesn't happen. I'm just saying that there are many times where negotiations do occur in private. And if we make it a rule that they're not, I think it'll happen. I have more confidence that people will abide by that rule.
Tamara, you keep asserting that negotiations take place in private. I've said, I'll say it again publicly, in all the major conference committees that I've chaired, there simply has not been private meetings. There simply has not been. So at least for me, you're talking about something that I have not experienced. Now, I didn't say the ones that I was on prior to becoming chair, because I did spend the first 10 years on conference committees where there rarely were public meetings. But that's a lot of years ago. And I'm not... Senator Bensel.
Well, conversations do take place. In my first couple of years here, I was on the human services track, and I think it was quite clear sometimes when you had Senator Samuelson in the Senate, Representative Greenfield from the House, and they'd disappear, and the other eight conferees would sit around for hours with nothing to do, and then they'd come back in and say, well, here's what we've got, here's what we've discussed. And, I mean, they'd run it past us.
And that was how many years ago?
Well, whenever, it was at least over eight years ago. Things have happened. Now, sometimes you have minor bills where the House author and the Senate author talk about things, and sometimes the conference committee never meets. You know, you, all of a sudden a conference committee bill shows up. Sometimes the House just accedes to the Senate position, and I guess the Senate would say, well, that's fine. Let's just do it that way, and they never meet. Everybody signs off. I think it's I'm not as concerned about it because ultimately the other conferees still have to agree, would have to sign off on it. And certainly any conference committee that I've been on, if I felt that there was, you know, not something I was comfortable with, I just wouldn't sign it. But, you know, I can't speak for other people. But I think that even if this rule were to be adopted, there would still be discussions one way or the other. I don't know how you can stop that from happening. I don't know what the remedy would be.
Do you want to stop it from happening?
I think to the extent that we have things in the open, it should be in the open. But as you may recall, for the last couple of years, we even had trouble having conference committees even meeting. So, but yeah, you know, and
no, seriously, do you not want members of a conference committee to talk to each other informally?
Oh, I think they do, and they will.
Okay.
They should.
And Sir Marty, you would think that's okay, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, informal conversations is one thing. Negotiating and making offers and accepting offers is a different thing.
Okay, but at what point does it become an offer if a conferee says to somebody else, look, what if I back off this? Would you be willing to do that? In an informal conversation, which happens all the time around here, would that be a violation of this? I think it would.
Mr. Chairman, the point is with people making, when people are going to have things and there is going to be a bit of a fuzzy line, but at a certain point, you can just say, I hope you'll be open to this and make the offer in public. There's no reason you can't do it that way. In the end, what we've come to is a thing where many times, and I'm not going to say a majority because I think there are very many conference committees that aren't, I mean, I think it tends to be more in budget areas where there is a package that's put together and it's negotiated off, and I've seen times where it goes back and forth. One side will make an offer, the other one will respond to the offer and so on in private. And I've only been on one tax conference committee, and I don't recall you doing that, but I do remember plenty of other conference committees that way. And if you've never experienced that, well, then good. There shouldn't be a problem with the rule.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Well, I've been on a number of conference committees, and I don't. You're going to have some discussions. I mean, it just. I think he's trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist, as far as I'm concerned, and I think we ought to reject this.
Yeah. Sir Marty, is there any way to stop a chair of a conference committee who does what you just described with any language you put in any rule? That's where I kind of come from. If someone is so inclined to do that, I don't know how we stop it, other than peer pressure.
Mr. Chairman.
Which I'm for. But I don't think, what I'm afraid this rule does, or this language, is it creates an impediment to informal behavior that actually can help get the work done and absolutely is in no way a violation of doing it in the open. It's a way of allowing people to have discussions, individuals, to try to get some. I mean, I walk out of the tax conference committee down the hall with Representative Krenke and said, Phil, how do we get out of this? What are we going to do? And at that moment, this language starts to say, stop that conversation, Larry. And I think that is not what you really want. I really don't.
Mr. Chairman, when you and Representative Krenke would walk out in the hall and have discussions and say, you know, how are we going to get out of this? And one of you says, well, I might be willing to look at this or something, but come back in an hour and sit down and go over it. I mean, that's the way it ought to happen. When you say if somebody's really intent on doing this, they're going to do it anyway. Again, I do remember a number of times when you have House members come over and, oh, how many are in the room? Let's make sure there aren't more than two in the room because that would be breaking the rule. Because people around here do try and abide by the rules. And if the rule says that you can't make or accept offers, then you'll just say, look, you know, we might be coming in with an offer, but think it over and make an offer on the floor. I mean, in the committee. I think it's not an unreasonable process, and I do believe members would change their behavior if this was enacted.
Okay. Does anybody want to offer the 014? Okay, Senator Marty, lacking...
I understand. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Marty. Okay, any other amendments to the joint rules?
Hey, Mr. Chair, just a quick question. A couple of years ago, I think Senator Betzold and I and Pottinger, we were on this committee to consider joint rules. One of the concepts that we recommended was in order to avoid so many conference committees from being appointed on relatively minor differences was to allow ping pong, if you remember that.
Yeah.
Have you had any discussions with the House to... I mean, for example, if there's one sentence difference or one word difference, technically we have to have a conference committee. And I think what we recommended is that we could bounce a bill back one more time apiece before we had to have a conference committee, or at least once. Any reaction to that?
First time I've heard thought.
Senator Betzold, do you remember?
Yeah, in fact, I remember, and I've still got my file on it, but we talked about, mainly these are the minor bills that wind up going to conference committee that probably don't have to, but it's only because one body puts something in and the other one says, I don't know what this means, or just I just can't accept the way it is, and we thought we'd try to find some way, again, that we could just send it back to the other house and, you know, the house of origin and say, okay, you know, how about this? And then and see. You probably could not do that on the major bills because those are going to go to conference committees anyway. But I think I still got the, at least some language we talked about, but we never resolved quite how to get it done then either. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in pursuing that if we got any inkle from the House that this would require you to go over and negotiate with them, maybe what we just talked about. But
we just would like to get some joint rules this year.
Yeah, that's true.
See, I think the Pappas Amendment might already kill the joint rules. Yeah. But
well, Senator Betzold and I could probably dig out that language from a couple of years back that, frankly, I don't think was that controversial.
Why don't we think about it for next set of rules next time?
All right.
Let's try to get some joint rules first.
Oh, not this 2 year round?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We'll still be here 2 years from now.
We want people to remember that conference committees are good things.
Well, there are a lot of things that we resolve without conference committees. We just have – we prepare the reports and circulate the conference jackets for signing, and we never do meet, right? Doesn't that happen?
All right.
You saying there's informal behavior to accomplish things?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Mr. Flavin, did you
play ping pong?
Mr. Chairman, apropos of Senator Neville's comment on the earlier discussion, it's been my observation that too many bills go to conference. Minor differences, and I've encouraged senators, why not just talk to your House chief author and try to put an amendment on this bill as it's going through the second body that the other body will accept and avoid the whole mishmash of going to conference. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But anyway, I have something.
I'm shocked. You view legitimate activity between the House and Senate as mishmash? There's a reason. There's a reason these things are set up this way. The idea here isn't to pass everything that somebody decides should become law. The ideal is to say, you know, unless this is really a good idea, let's not get there too fast.
Well, I mean, Mr. Chair, what happens is there's a floor amendment, and it's not controversial necessarily, but it requires it forces the conference committee, and the other body might very well take it if we allowed one more ping or pong.
Yeah. Sometimes we like things to get to conference because there's often things that get in bills that we've been unable to fix.
All right, let's go.
Has nobody experienced that? There are often things in both sides that are in a bill that we've been unable to fix, and we need a conference committee to fix those ideas. As a true conservative, I think you know what I'm saying.
Well, I don't know how far you want me. Do you want me to tell you about the conference committee I was on once?
No.
That no, I won't tell you right now.
Mr. Flobman, do you have an idea you want to promote here? Or
yes, Mr. Chairman. I found a note in the rules file that Patrice Dvorak had given me last year, the year before, and a little note said, when they take up the permanent joint rules, there had been some issues at that time about if conference committees met after midnight, you know, between midnight and 7 a.m., and there is in Joint Rule 2.06 on line 6.24, starts the language where the conference committee shouldn't meet between midnight and 7 a.m.
Yep.
At that time, Patrice's note said, maybe what they want to do is put that language in that after the last Thursday in which the legislature can meet in regular session, which appears on the next page, on line 7.14, you know, where it talks about when conference committees have to be on the desks. And it says after the last Thursday on which we can meet, and then it goes on, that you don't have to meet the 12-hour rule. And the idea would be to say that after the last Thursday on which we can meet, conference committees could meet between midnight and 7 a.m. I think at the time this came up, there was some controversy about whether a committee had met after midnight and should we even be taking this up and that sort of thing. And putting a provision in the joint rule that would say that during those last days, a conference committee could meet between midnight and 7 without extending for an hour or violating the joint rules. So I'm offering that as a thought. If I'd found the note earlier, I would have done an amendment, but I'm just tossing it out because it's something that occurred to us.
Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion on the joint rules? Senator Senjum moves that CREST J rules, whatever CREST. All that is, 07. What's concurrent resolution joint rules, I think is what that all says.
How far did
07, as amended, be recommended to pass. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Thanks, members. Appreciate it. Rules is on Wednesday. And Mr. Watson tells me that if we actually get these rules passed by the Senate, it'll be the first time in many years that we've got them done this early. I apologize for being ill last week, but the idea was to get them done last week. So appreciate members' flexibility. Senator Metzen, thank you for your flexibility. And obviously, if these things don't work out, we'll change the rules at some point. Okay?
Yep.
Meeting adjourned.
Okay.
I don't think so.